Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs to order. It is now 8:03 a.m. Tuesday, March 19th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Kopp, Representative Lincoln, Vice Chair Edgman, Representative Ortez, and myself, Representative Zelkowski, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. If everyone would please take a moment to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you in advance. Before we begin, I would like to thank Tribal Affairs Committee aide Grace Singh, Julia Bushman, the Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. We will begin today's hearing on rural public safety and justice with a presentation from Vivian Corthius, President of the Association of Village Council Presidents. Ms. Corthius, please come forward, state your name for the record, and begin your presentation.
Good morning. Okay, so for me to flip this, is it me or is it someone else? Apologize for setting up here. Good morning. My name is Vivian Corthius. I serve as the Chief Executive Officer for the Association of Village Council Presidents in Bethel, Alaska. Before I start, I'd like to give you a little bit of my background. I was born and raised on the YK Delta. I grew up in Emonic. My parents are Jake Johnson, Eunice Hunter. My grandparents are Axel C. Johnson, Zena Beans is my grandmother, Pearly Johnson is my dad's dad, and my grandfather is Don Hunter of Marshall. So I'm the eldest of seven children. I attended Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka, graduated from Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Received a master's degree in education from UAF and currently am enrolled in the PhD program for Indigenous Research at UAF. I've worked for AVCP for the past 16 years. I'm the CEO for the past 2 years. So my work experience spans healthcare and social service delivery to the YK Delta. Prior to that, I taught high school in Bethel. So that's a short summary of my background.
As you take a sip of water, I'd like to recognize Representative Hopkins has joined us.
So I've prepared a PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to walk through the presentation, and I'm going to also, when we have time, I'm going to talk a little bit about the dynamics of providing public safety in the YK Delta. And if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer them. So AVCP is the regional native nonprofit for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region of Western Alaska. We encompass 48 villages, 48 communities along the Yukon River, Kuskokwim River, and Bering Sea Coast. We have 56 federally recognized tribes. We have a very, very large service area consisting 23% of the tribes in Alaska and 10% of the tribes in the nation. We are the largest Native consortium in the country. The size of AVCP is very, very large. We have a service delivery model that provides services in the villages, in subregions, in Bethel itself as a hub, and then beyond, say in Anchorage or wherever some of our clients may live. The region meets, the tribes in the region meet on an annual basis in Bethel usually. We bring the tribes together to meet. Our executive board also leads the organization, and the amount of employees that we have varies depending on the season. For example, summertime it goes up, but we have approximately 400 employees. So over time, we've been able to address public safety in the AVCP region, starting off with AVCP being the very first contractor in the state to provide public safety. We're really proud that the idea of public safety came from our region. We are very vested in the idea of public safety. We believe that public safety is necessary for our communities to feel safe. If you follow the development of the VPSO program, you will know it grew and then it eventually has declined. And that story is the story that we're going to be talking about today. It's a valid service that we provide, and we believe that it is necessary in all of our villages. Today, we only have 88% of the communities in the AVCP region that do not have, it's not only, it, we have 88% of the communities in our region that do not have a public safety officer. So we came to this realization and we started working on it. Our region, through our tribal delegates to the convention, made this the number one priority of the whole region. So if you think about it, 88% without public safety, that's 48 villages that have a baseline of only currently 6 VPSOs. That's a crisis. The question then is, how is law enforcement provided in our region? The types of law enforcement in our region and all across rural Alaska include the VPSO, VPO, TPO, and the state troopers. As I've stated before, the annual convention at AVCP for the past 2 years has prioritized public safety as the number one issue for AVCP to work on, and that's what we've been doing. Village public safety officers. Again, we're very proud to say that the VPSO program originated in our region. AVCP held the very first VPSO contract with the state of Alaska, and I've spoken with the people that have were drafting that contract, and it's a real story that we're very, very proud of, because a lot of the solutions that we see that work nowadays have roots in the region, and that's really what we believe that we should address in this whole discussion of public safety, is that public safety has to work for the villages. And that's what this program does. It came from our communities, and it fits our region. It fits our villages. And that's the last point of this slide, is that the AVCP region has the memory and experience of the intent of this program. It's not something that we want to get rid of. We have VPSOs who are currently employed who were the very first VPSOs. So that memory is there, and the intent and the belief in this program is real in our villages. VPSO, the officers are employed by the regional native nonprofits, tribe, or the borough. the MOA between the state of Alaska and the nonprofit and the local governing body outlines the agreement that the VPSOs work under. And we really put a lot of effort into this MOA because we have to make sure that the understanding through that MOA is present in all of our, every one of our placements of our VPSOs. The funding through DPS, through the contract, is really important. AVCP manages many, many, many contracts, and this is just one of the contracts that we manage. The program began in 1979 to provide public safety to rural communities. Public safety facilities and housing are provided by the village governing body. Our coordinator, our director of public safety in our region, he puts a lot of time and effort visiting and making sure that that relationship with the tribes or the city in each of those villages is a good working relationship. That's the mechanism in which we provide this service and the partnership with the tribes and the regional, within the region and the municipal governments in the region that we serve. For training, VPSOs receive 15-week training. At ALET training, the state troopers receive the same training. They must pass a background check and a physical test, and the minimum age is 21. And I'm going to talk about some of the challenges that we've noticed in the past regarding getting the training done with VPSOs. In my experience, whenever we ask a question, and at least when I talk with my staff, whenever you ask a question, you have to have an answer. So I'm going to bring issues up, and if we don't have an answer, we actually want to talk about the process to getting where we want to be. So in that manner, I'm just going to continue with the slides, and then when these issues come up, I'll talk about that. The VPSO training focuses on five public safety areas. So the focus of the VPSOs, and this is a picture of the VPSOs in our region, I believe 2 years ago at our annual convention, is law enforcement, search and rescue, emergency medical services, fire and water safety. These are just the acknowledged focus of the VPSOs. They are so much more than this. The VPSOs in our villages, this is what I always talk about when I talk with provide testimonies. In our villages, the VPSO and the health aide are the right hand and the left hand of every community. Every one of our villages, if anything goes on to where there is a emergency or anything that needs immediate attention, it's either the VPSO or the health aide, and they're the right hand and the left hand of every village in our region. Again, like I stated, the AVCP region only has six VPSOs. We went down from 8 to 6 last week. If you average it out, it's only one officer for every 8 communities. That is amazingly incomprehensible for me to sit here and say that we only have 8 VPSOs to serve 48 villages. VPOs, they are employed by the municipal government. They receive their funds through the city. The training is summarized on the screen. I'm not going to go into that detail. Minimum age is 19. The tribal police officers, again, employed by the tribal government. funded through the tribe, either through grant funding, or this is something that I want to bring out too, is that what we've learned in communicating and going through our region is that the tribal police officers, we heard stories of the tribal police officers being funded by bingo, bake sales, or other resources. So the tribal police officers themselves don't have a really stable funding line that they can our communities can count on. And then the training, I'm not going to go through that, and minimum age is 19. Alaska State Troopers, funded by the state through DPS, and then the training must be 21 to start the academy. So I'm going to talk about barriers to providing rural law enforcement. And I've jotted down some other additional notes that I want to share with you, so I'm going to go through this slide. Some of the barriers that we've experienced and witnessed include requirements to arm VPSOs resulted in a more stringent background check. So this is a real barrier for some of the candidates that we see. Many, many times we know that when we create a career path for some, say for example, for VPSOs, that career path starts really when they're in high school, grade school, and it goes up along till after high school when you create the opportunity for a career and something that you can make a living on. The challenge is that, as we all know, many, many different situations occur in our communities, including those things that we may not know of, that will come back when people are older to bite them. And that includes something like a background check. Those things that young people do that they don't understand that will stop them in their path, career path, from doing what they really want to do. So we find that in this barrier of creating opportunities for our youth, and that background check is a barrier that we find more than often than not in the communities. When we actually get a candidate and go through the process, those background checks take up to 5 months. So that process alone gets people frustrated. And what generally tends to happen is when those young people want to go to work, if they know that they can have a fishing job for the summer or work in the cannery or a construction job, they're not going to go through this process and wait that long. They have to have things in that career path that makes sense to them, and waiting 5 months or half a year just to get the background check is an obstacle that we're trying to figure out. Some of the recruitment issues that we've come across, again, is prior drug use, barrier crimes, family and community support. And the challenge of these individuals who may have to arrest their family members or friends. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of these things. So last week, we had a VPSO who could not finish his training because the community support that he and his young family had, he had two children and his spouse, you know, they have to be alone for that those 15 weeks, and sometimes that is just too much to handle. So taking a look at the training and the how far they have to go and the connection to their community, those individuals that are interested in this career path, that has to work for them. And if it doesn't, they're going to opt out of that training. The academy, again, for the VPSOs is far away from our region. It makes total sense to look at a model that looks closer to the region. We have a lack of required public safety infrastructure, jail cells, office building, and housing. These are some of the challenges that we're addressing in our region. For this specific challenge, we created an assessment, and I'll talk about that. And then lastly, the challenge of working alone in communities, feeling that isolation, and the secondary trauma that police officers experience.
Representative Lincoln has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know which year we started arming the VPSOs?
I believe 4 or 5 years ago. I don't know the exact date.
Please continue.
Thank you. So this next slide, this is where I'm going to defer to some of my written notes here, because I really want to talk about what the AVCP region has been doing in the past 2 years to address the number one priority in our region. So as you know, that public safety is the number one priority of the AVCP region. Our tribes over the last 2 years have attended the AVCP convention and twice have verified and said to everyone that public safety is the issue that our tribes want to see addressed immediately, right away. It is the issue of our region that AVCP wholeheartedly believes in that needs to be addressed. So the very first thing we did was we started gathering information. We wanted to capture the baseline for our need for public safety, and we started to organize. It's a very methodical approach. We wanted to gather information and to define what we're talking about. So we created a statewide strategic plan. We created a public safety facilities assessment, and then we also had a public safety summit. I'm going to talk about each of these, how these came together.
And just a comment for our committee members is there are copies of these documents that have been provided to you this morning. Please continue.
Okay. So the first thing that I'd like to talk about is the VPSO strategic plan. So we recognize that without a roadmap, we can be all over the place for public safety. So we gathered the stakeholders. The stakeholders are the contractors, Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, and we created the space and the time to create a strategic plan. Because that strategic plan is really what should be guiding the discussion about public safety in all of rural Alaska. So in that strategic plan that you have a copy of, we had it facilitated. We invited the stakeholders. We had really good discussions over a period of two days, I believe. And we created an outline to have discussions. We documented those discussions, and then we created the report or the strategic plan in a written form. So the priorities in the strategic plan include communication. We knew that without communication at all levels between the communities and the regions, the contractors and the state, the regional native nonprofits and the city governments, the tribal governments, that whole dynamic of the players or the stakeholders have to have really good communication to let each other know what's going on across the board. So we're committed to that in through our strategic plan. Our goal was to create a way or some kind of method to make a VPSO available to every community that wanted a VPSO. Some of our communities are so large that they need three or four VPSOs. But we wanted to make a way to have a VPSO in every village if that's the request of the community. And the strategic plan committed to making that happen. What we really wanted to do was we really, through that method, through that way of establishing that every one of our communities that needed a VPSO are able to have a VPSO, is we wanted to create that pipeline, a methodology to create the pipeline for communities to say, yes, we want a VPSO, and this is why we want a VPSO. This is for our communities to bring forth their requests to the state that we, the community, really believes in the VPSO program and we want them in our villages. The third is we wanted to create this. Yes.
Before you move on, just a quick question. Under this priority, it indicates, in addition to funding all of the necessary positions, providing proper support infrastructure. Can you define what that is for the committee?
Can I pull it out?
Sure.
Oh, wait, you have it. It's okay. So I'm not going to, I don't have it in front of me, but the proper support and facilities, I can talk about facilities next, but the infrastructure for the VPSO program is really everything that a VPSO needs to do their job, including all the equipment, all the training, all the resources, the support. I would even go as far as saying the housing, the facilities or the actual community buildings that that VPSO can work out of, those types of things.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the third outcome of the strategic plan includes a discussion around program governance. We wanted to create the space in which the stakeholders can talk about how the VPSO is organized, how it's governed, the relationship between the different stakeholders, say the state and the tribe, the state and the contractor. In many cases, it's the regional native nonprofit or borough. So we wanted to talk about the governance, how we administer and govern or the oversight of the VPSO program. The next one is we wanted, in the strategic plan, we wanted to create the space and the time to talk about adequate funding and policies. So, in our region, how this applies to our region is this. We have 48 villages. 88% of those 48 villages does not have a VPSO in that village. So even if we were to start at the beginning, we would have to figure out how to fund 88% of our communities that have no presence of VPSOs at all. And then, of course, the policies about actually providing the services in the villages. So in our opinion, and our tribes in our region are saying that we are experiencing really in our villages a crisis of public safety, and that's why for the past 2 years at the AVCP convention that our tribes and our members and our communities are saying that VPSOs, public safety, is our number one issue for the YK Delta. The second document that I want to talk about is the facility assessment.
Before you move on, can you just, so I just want to clarify, the VPSO strategic plan that was developed in concert with several stakeholders was completed in 2018?
Yes.
And was that provided to the Department of Public Safety upon completion, and did they have?
Yes, they participated as a stakeholder.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The second, the second document that I want to talk about is the facility assessment. The facility assessment that AVCP put together last summer was really an amazing process. Our goal was to create the baseline for facilities. In our region, and we put a team together, the VPSO department, our IT department, our tribal services department, our facilities department, and we targeted 2, 3, 4 villages every day. So every week for 6 weeks, 3 or 4 times per week, our staff would be out in the region conducting these assessments. And the goal was to create some kind of baseline, gather the information, and to determine what's out there in our region. So this is what we found, and we took pictures. We took pictures of the facilities. We took pictures of the buildings. I'm going to ask you a question. Did you want me to speed up, slow down?
Continue. Please
okay,
continue.
Thank you. So the facility assessment, of the 48 villages, we found that 38 have existing public safety facilities. 4 of these facilities require major renovation or replacement. 24 of the 48 facilities require renovation of some sort. 9 of the communities don't have any facilities. And 26 don't have dedicated public safety housing. That is our baseline from which we operate the public safety in our villages, irregardless of who manages or administers the contract to provide public safety. That's what we found in talking with the municipal governments, the tribes, all the stakeholders in every village. One of the things that complicates this whole thing is that, as you know, some of the federal grants require that the villages, last week I talked to one of the communities, and They were trying for a federal grant, and they didn't have a public safety facility in their community. Therefore, they could not proceed with the federal grant. So these are some of the things that are surfacing, is that the conditions of the facilities and the conditions of housing and just the overall need in our villages for the facilities is really, really great. I really want to thank the AVCP staff and the communities for working on this public safety assessment, because it really provides a clear picture of what those conditions are in our villages and what our villages have to provide, irregardless of the condition of the physical structure of public safety in our villages. The last document is the Public Safety Summit Outcome Document. The idea behind the summit in our region came from the discussions we had at the annual conventions. At the annual conventions, our tribes were describing the issues that they had to work with in their villages. We had very strong outcries from our tribes and our communities of the need for public safety in our region. We had testimony at our annual conventions about how it was so difficult to get a solution to an emergency, and leaders in communities in our region talking about how our tribes needed that public safety, and many, many, many times there was really no way to address it. So out of that came this idea for a public safety summit in the YK Delta. So when we put together the summits, we realized that the process of a summit is really important, creating that time and that space for stakeholders throughout our region to come together and talk about it. That process was just as important as the outcome document. So we gathered approximately 150, maybe 200 people, stakeholders, different stakeholders, municipal government, search and rescue teams, tribes, city council members, tribal council members, women's shelters, all the stakeholders in our region, and we went through a process of defining public safety. And in the report, you can take a look at what our region said public safety was. And one of the things that I have to tell you is, through this process, what we learned is public safety has to be looked at in the context of the whole community. In other words, a holistic approach, and that's what we learned out of this summit. You can't talk about public safety without talking about the other things that are priority in a community by itself. You can't look at this thing called public safety by itself. That's what we learned out of this summit.
Mm-hmm. Representative Edgman has a question.
So thank you for being here, Vivian. So in looking at everything holistically, you looked at the problem of alcohol and drugs and sort of the underlying, the root causes of, high rates of domestic violence.
Yes.
And everything else that constitutes public safety in the village level.
Yes, we did. That is what we learned through our summit. And the summit outcome document, again, like I said, the process of addressing public safety is just as important as the outcome document or the reports or the strategic plans or these documents that we have presented to this hearing today. What that means is that all the stakeholders in our region, all the stakeholders in our villages, those that have roles, leadership roles in our communities, they are the ones that have come together to say this is what our region wants. That was a really critical, important step in this process, to go to the community level and talk about this issue, because what we realize is that that holistic approach means we have to deliver the services holistically as well. So in that outcome document, we have the prioritized issues by unit. AVCP region is so large that we have 13 units where clusters of villages come together, and that's where they talked about what their priorities are, and you can see them in that report. We created the time and the space to talk about the challenges, and you mentioned some of them, including drugs, alcohol, no law enforcement, the decreased National Guard presence, lack of funding. All these issues came out in those discussions and are documented in the outcome document.
And I just want to do a quick time check, Ms. Corthius, if you can go ahead and continue, but we want to make sure that we get to our other presenters this morning.
Thank you. And then our outcome document talked about solutions, and these again are by unit. It was really important for this summit to be facilitated, so we had staff facilitate those discussions and recorded. And that's why we set in motion this first phase of documenting the need. And these three documents, the strategic plan, the facility assessment, and the summit, created that baseline from which the strategy is now to work from there. So what do we know? We know that the state of Alaska has a responsibility for public safety in our communities. We know that. The VPSO program is a critical part of the state of Alaska's responsibility to provide equitable safety to all Alaskans. Establishing and maintaining the partnership between tribes and the state is essential for public safety. We know that. We know that everything considered, again, like I said, if we ask a question, we have to have an answer. So these are our recommendations. Support the 2018 statewide VPSO strategic plan. Review the entire structure of the VPSO program to give regions the flexibility we need to create solutions that work for our communities. A tool, for example, is compacting. Move the VPSO program directly under the Commissioner for Public Safety on par with the Alaska State Troopers. Plan 1 to 3 years for effective changes. And lastly, retain and fund the VPSO program. Thank you. Oriana.
Yeah. Representative Lincoln has a question.
Do you know roughly what percentage of the village residents in your region are tribal citizens?
I don't know the exact data, but it's maybe above 90%.
Yeah. And
follow up?
And have some of your tribes been able to access federal dollars to provide public safety? Are you familiar with?
Yes, they have. That is an application process. And like I said, last week I spoke with a tribal administrator, and that tribal administrator was trying to do that. But in her community, there was no facility, so she could not provide the match for that grant application. So therefore, she could not apply for those funds.
And are you aware of any, like, general barriers to, it seems like there might be an opportunity to leverage some federal dollars in partnership with the state and tribes and the federal government to help fund some of this, but do you, are you aware of any sort of general barriers to that, or is there any legal issues preventing better cooperation?
Legal issues to...
I think different states have different arrangements with Indian
yes.
country and
Alaska is a PL 280 state, mm-hmm. and that is an issue that I think needs to be discussed.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Ms. Corthius, we want to say Koyana Chuknuk, thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for making time to go through this work so comprehensively, and all of the investment that AVCP in the YK Delta region has done for the VPSO program. It's very evident that this is a number one priority for the region, and we appreciate your time here with us today.
Thank you. We do support the VPSO program. We believe it's essential in our communities, and we will help in any way to advance that agenda.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kopp.
Yes, Ms. Corthius, I just wanted to say, as someone who's worked with VPSOs for many years, I appreciate the thoroughness of your presentation, and we're definitely with you in resolving this issue on a broader scale for all of Alaska, and thank you for clarifying a number of challenges before us. That wonderful presentation.
Thank you very much. Koyana.
We will now turn our attention to a presentation by Public Safety Commissioner Designee Amanda Price. Ms. Price, please come forward, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation.
To the chairs and the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Amanda Price, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Public Safety. I would like to thank Ms. Corthius also for presenting that information, and she actually presented several topics that I am going to be touching on as well. I took the opportunity today when receiving this request to make sure that, as Ms. Corthius indicated, the topic of public safety is not limited to one specific function, group, or initiative, and instead needs to be much more holistic and broad-based. So I did include in my presentation a snapshot of some of the efforts that take place from this department across the state that impact rural public safety. And at the direction of the chairs for this presentation, I'm certainly ready, willing, and looking forward to engaging in conversation about the Village Public Safety Officer Program as well. However, before we get to that, I would just like to briefly acknowledge what the overarching mission of the Department of Public Safety is, which is to administer functions relative to the protection of life and property. Our core services include law enforcement patrol and investigations, rural law enforcement services, domestic violence and sexual assault programs, statewide public safety programs, resource protection, and highway safety. In the category of statewide public safety programs, it is included core service areas like running the Alaska Public Safety Network, the APSIN program, the State Crime Lab, which processes all forensic evidence received from municipalities throughout the state, as well as the Alaska State Troopers, our Division of Fire and Life Safety that responds to arson and fire fatalities in the United States. Alaska is number one per capita in fire fatalities, so those investigations are of critical importance as we work to understand why we experience fire fatalities at such a high rate. And then our resource protection includes Alaska Wildlife Troopers along with Alaska Wildlife Trooper Marine and aircraft. divisions. And the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, I just like to take the opportunity to put forward to the committee, are Alaska State Troopers. So there is often some confusion in communities. If there is a wildlife trooper placed in a community, that community has come to me and said, we don't have a trooper in our community. Alaska Wildlife Troopers are Alaska State Troopers. They just operate with an additional focus on resource protection. One of the divisions or councils within the Department of Public Safety is the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is charged with providing funding services to prevent and respond effectively to crimes of domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexual abuse of a minor. I included just a snapshot of where in Alaska some of these efforts are funded and focused. One of the areas that the CDVSA, as it is referred to, provides is documentation, information, booklets that are translated into a variety of different languages. We've also funded prevention efforts in this list of communities that you see here, and there are actually many other communities that the CDVSA has provided funding efforts to in an attempt to, I'm not sure which member of the committee put it forward, but in an attempt to understand, identify the root causes of violence in our communities. The prevention funding that flows out to these communities is often in strong partnership with the communities and is very tailored and specific to the issues that an individual community is struggling with. The CDVSA funds 24 victim service programs throughout the state.
Representative Ortiz has a question. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to that funding support to these different communities, can you talk a little bit about the form that takes? Like, for example, in my community, I know that there is a domestic violence shelter. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about as opposed to, well, explain.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, thank you for your question. And yes, sir, we do certainly fund the emergency shelter program. However, in every community that's listed here receives a different level of prevention support. So we have programs such as coaching boys into men, Lead On, Girls on the Run. There's a large number of prevention programming that takes place in the communities. And again, in partnership with the communities, the CDVSA engages in conversation and helps to provide funding for the program that the community indicates will be the most impactful for their region.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, sir.
Just for the purpose of time, I will ask members to hold questions until the end of the presentation. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The CDVSA funds 24 victim service programs. Most of them, as Representative Ortiz indicated, provide emergency shelter, although not all provide emergency shelter. Standing Together Against Rape in Anchorage is one that is funded through the CDVSA but does not, in fact, operate an emergency shelter program. They provide response to sexual assault survivors statewide. Programs also provide safety planning and community-based advocacy to victims of domestic violence and victims of sexual assault. And a person does not need to be a shelter resident in order to receive services in any of our communities. This is a snapshot of the programs that the CDVSA funds in terms of the shelter program component. I won't go through the list, but I will just reflect that there are four programs listed on this slide that have an asterisk next to them. They are Petersburg, Craig, the Kenaitse Indian Tribe, and where's my other one? A Monic Women's Shelter, thank you. Those are the four programs that were funded, newly funded this year through the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The next slide is a snapshot of felony sex offenses in our state. Sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor, and domestic violence continue to be a primary concern for our state. And in Western Alaska, we experience as a state exorbitant rates of crimes of that nature. I bring this to your attention because I will walk through very briefly just some of the efforts that the Department of Public Safety has deployed while understanding the sheer volume of crimes that we experience in Western Alaska particularly. And some of the efforts that we currently have underway and how we are going to be addressing, responding to, and ideally preventing the crimes of domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexual abuse of a minor. In Bethel, there was the creation of the Alaska State Troopers Violent Offenders Unit. That unit was created in 2015. And the purpose of the unit was to primarily focus on investigating felony-level crimes such as sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor. Those crimes are incredibly challenging to investigate. They are very nuanced, particularly in the manner with which Alaska experiences those crimes. Very often our sexual assault and sexual abuse, I'll focus specifically on sexual assault, our sexual assaults include individuals who know one another, and generally there's a large number of the reported crimes of sexual assault that are consent-based, meaning both parties indicate there was in fact sexual encounter, but the question is whether or not there was consent. So in those cases, forensic evidence or other such evidence that might be used in a stranger assault are not as easily supportive of a criminal case. So it takes very specific training and understanding to investigate successfully those challenging cases. Recently, in January of this year, we were very proud to hire and place a sexual assault investigator in the Bethel District Attorney's Office. That position has been working since January. We will be monitoring the success of the collaboration with the DAs. The intent is to have the investigator work alongside of the DA to strengthen our cases and an opportunity to see more effective resolution through our criminal justice system on these cases. I would just put out for consumption that we will be hiring a second position that mirrors this position. We anticipate in May we will make that hire, and it will be in the interior. We also are continuing to work through the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, which, as many of the members know, a few years ago in 2015, the state requested an audit of all law enforcement entities to capture the data of unsubmitted sexual assault kits. We had thousands of unsubmitted sexual assault kits that law enforcement entities had not previously submitted to the crime lab for processing for a variety of reasons. The state crime lab is actively continuing to work on those previously unsubmitted kits while also working to ensure that they are staying in a processing the real-time kits that they're receiving in a timely manner. We have engaged and completed several research projects in collaboration with the UAA Justice Center, and this data that we have received from the UAA Justice Center, and which this department will continue to engage really diligently in, informs the policies of the Alaska State Troopers in an effort to improve the response and the manner with which we respond to crimes, particularly in rural Alaska. One such research project focused on the factors that impact a decision of a police investigator to refer a case to prosecution versus why they may not have referred a case to prosecution. And the other factor on behalf of the prosecutor indicated or reflected which factors made it more likely for the prosecutor to accept a case for prosecution. So as we evaluate those two different decision points in the criminal justice process, you can certainly see how it will improve the Alaska State Troopers' opportunity to do a more thorough investigation, to understand the factors that lead to successful referral to the Department of Law, and to partner with the Department of Law in making sure they have everything they need to accept those cases for prosecution. The department believes that this research will addresses and continues to address, at least in some capacity, the concerns that were put forward in the 2018 AFN Resolution 1811, which called for an investigation of the treatment in the Alaska criminal justice system of cases involving Alaska Native offenders and victims. We are also engaging very shortly in a project with the UAA Justice Center that is a descriptive analysis of death investigations. After the initial analysis of death investigations statewide takes place, there will be a primary focus on homicides. The intent of this research project is to support and determine what the factors are and if there is disparate treatment with regards to how a homicide or a missing person, in fact, is treated based on race, as was brought to our attention and the nation's concern on the topic of missing and murdered Indigenous girls and women. This slide is simply a snapshot of where we have placement of the Alaska State Troopers Statewide Drug Enforcement Unit. These units work in collaboration and conjunction with all entities, federal entities, municipal entities. It is a very collaborative process, and these units are very successful in interdicting drugs. Alcohol continues to be of primary concern, particularly in our rural communities, and these groups focus on those issues. So, and there's a great deal more that the Department of Public Safety does on behalf of Alaskans and improving public safety throughout all of our communities, but I understand that there is a focus on the program of the Village Public Safety Officer program specifically. So I have put on this slide just the statutory authority that governs and determines what the authority of an Alaska State Trooper is and what the description and authority of a Village Public Safety Officer is. I would like to just comment that there is a great deal of there are terms that are interchangeably used when we talk about the Village Public Safety Officer program that are not accurate. One such term that is not accurate is the term contractor as opposed to grantee. The Village Public Safety Officer grant is a grant. The state of Alaska is to grant those funds to the nonprofit organizations. Those nonprofit organizations are grantees of the state, not contractors. The difference is that a contract is when you engage in a relationship where one party is promising the other party that they're going to complete an action, that is a contractor. A grantee is where a grant is administered to an entity with the reasonable expectation that that entity will provide a service. It's a slight definition shift, but just for purposes of clarity, I would like to point out statutorily the programs are grantees. Let's ask you a
question. Representative Edgman.
So if thank you for being here. So if that's the case, why do we hear so many times from the entities that oversee the VPSO program, the eight non-for-profits and the one borough, that the state sometimes is a hindrance in terms of how the VPSO program is contracted? If in fact BB&A, ABCP, Quorick, TCC, if they're all mere grantees, then that tells me, or it seems to signify, that they would have more control, whereas that's not the case, because I think the department does exert some control over what actually happens downstream at the local level.
Representative Edgman, Mr. Chairman. Yes, thank you for your question. So I would first just say, from my perspective, mere grantee, that they are a grantee, and I think that the responsibility and partnership that takes place between the departments, whether we refer to them as contractors or grantees, is necessary and strong. The fiduciary responsibility of the department in a grant relationship is to ensure that the services are being rendered. So certainly there must be some control over how those funds are being expended. And I can give you an example, several examples, sir, but I'll give you just one example of why the state and why this department has historically engaged in sort of administrative oversight of how the funds are spent. We have had some challenges historically of where the funding has gone. We had one grantee that purchased $90,000 in materials, and those materials were not utilized for the program. As the fiduciary responsibility, this department must understand where and how the funds are being used. So certainly there must be some administrative oversight with regards to how the funds are being expended from the grantees. Follow up.
So as a follow up, and I think we're starting to sort of delve a little bit deeper into some of the fundamental reasons why perhaps this program isn't succeeding. And I think I've heard you say in previous testimony that the program, the VPSO program, is in fact broken. So I guess I'd like to hear your maybe quick take, I know we're limited on time here, on how we could further strengthen those relationships, because I hear repeatedly that the state sometimes is a deterrent, not an asset, in terms of how well the program actually conducts what it's supposed to do. And so I'm really intrigued by your emphasis on the word contractor and grantee, almost as if to suggest that the money passes through, again, ABCP, and then the state stands back and has very little responsibility, when in fact, I know the $3 million that's in the supplemental, if I'm not mistaken, your department has denied someone's request to actually use that money, and instead you know, elected to turn it back into the general treasury by way of a budget reduction.
Representative Edgman, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your question. I'll start at the end of your statement and work my way back. The department has not denied any said requests for any funding through it from any nonprofit that is granted funding through the VPSO program this year. So we'll start there and then work my way back. The reason I use the word grantee is it's dictated in AS 1865-670. It's not my word, it's the statutory language that governs the program. That's the simple reason as to why I use that word. I do believe that the program is incredibly challenged, and I agree with Vivian on what those challenges are. I would suggest that the state is obligated to ensure that, as Vivian stated, there is a public safety crisis, and the program is not at this moment providing adequate response to address the crisis. As I look in a linear capacity at the program, money is not going to solve this challenge. We had money. We have money. We've had money for the last several years. The money's not being used. So I think sometimes there is the hypothetical situations that are put forward, but to date this year, we've received three special project requests from grantees. All three were approved, and we still have
Ms. Price,
funding.
I'd like to actually clarify.
Sure.
We received information from some VPSO grantees that actually indicated that both in FY17 and FY18, there were in fact special projects that had been denied in the amounts of over $150,000. Looking at almost $60,000, both for training, support, equipment, items that have all been allowable expenses. So can you clarify when you're stating that special projects have not been denied? In fact, in the last couple of fiscal years, they have been.
Certainly, Madam Chair. I was reflecting that in FY19, there have been no denials for special projects.
We would actually like to see some follow-up from your department on that information. So if you can provide that to me and I can circulate that to the committee, I would appreciate it.
Certainly, Madam Chair. And I also have in front of me a list of every special project that's been received over the last several years. Some of the special projects that have been declined, for example, a fire truck for Kasan, the road system would not allow for the fire truck. So we did deny that special request, but it was not a denial because we determined that the community didn't need it. It wasn't functional, and in partnership with that community, we engaged in that conversation. But I'm certainly happy to provide you with the full listing of the special project request and the status over the last couple of years.
Thank you for that. In terms of a follow-up to that question, can you give some clarity to our committee about who makes the decisions related to whether to fund these special projects and if there's a process for appealing these decisions? And before you do that, I want to recognize that Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I ask through the chairs if I could go through the rest of, there's only two or three more slides, and I might hit on some of the topics as we continue.
I think
through
before you do that, if you could just clarify for us who makes the decisions on whether to fund special projects.
Certainly, through the chair, under the authority of the statute that governs the program and the regulations that guide the program, the Department of Public Safety makes the decisions in partnership with the grantees. And I will ask Captain Merrill, who Captain Andrew Merrill is the C Detachment Commander and has been the commander of the Village Public Safety Officer Program for several years. Captain Merrill, are you online and can you please address the question?
There is a Barry Wilson on the line, not Captain Merrill.
Captain, it's Colonel. Colonel Barry Wilson is the director of the Alaska State Troopers. Colonel, can you address the question?
And now we're unmuted. Captain Merrill is online and available to answer that question, has significant detail if he could be able allowed to answer that question.
Right ahead.
Captain Merrill.
Okay, good morning. Chairman and committee, this is Captain Andrew Merrill. I'm the Alaska State Trooper VPSO Program Commander, as well as the Sea Detachment Commander for Western Alaska. To answer that question, when we receive special requests, they come in a couple of different ways. The first way is when a grantee applies at the beginning of the grant year each year, they can input requests for special projects. Those special projects are reviewed, and depending on the amount of information that's received, if it if those requests contain information such as the scope of the project, as well as the cost of the project, projected bidding, as well as other processes that the grantee uses to establish the cost of those projects, if there's enough adequate information and it's in support of the VPSO program, those projects can be approved upon the receipt of the grant application. And so in some cases, those special projects are approved as part of the grant application at the beginning of the year. In some cases, they're not funded because the goal of our program is to hire VPSOs. So in some cases, based on past performance, we will approve those projects, but we won't provide or identify specific funding in the grant for those, anticipating that throughout the year, the grantees will have some vacancies, which will allow for some lapse funding to be used for those special projects. So that's one way that those special projects are received and approved. If enough information isn't included in the grant application to support the project or the necessity of the project, or for example, we have questions about, you know, we want to buy a fire truck, will that fire truck work in the community? We don't deny those applications or those special projects. We simply say it's not approved, but we need additional information throughout the year to support that, and then we can make a final determination in working with the grantee. And so in those cases, they're not approved, but they're not denied, and we don't fund them until we have more information. In other cases, if the project doesn't appear to meet the needs or the scope of the VPSO program, for example, one organization wanted to spend $400,000 to build a regional public safety building. And so in that case, we needed more information, and to use that amount of funding to build a building that's a regional type building as opposed to supporting VPSOs in each community, those types of requests are denied. We track those requests, as the commissioner said, and we started that a couple years ago because of some of the challenges we've had in working with the grantees. So those are requests that we receive at the beginning of the year. We also receive requests throughout the year, and so sometimes the grantees will request something they weren't aware of that comes up in the middle of the year. That can be done through a supplemental request. It's a form that we developed that in the office that the grantees can fill it out, submit it to our office with the supporting documentation. We review that to make sure that it meets the needs of providing public safety and supporting the VPSO in the communities. And then based on that, we will determine whether or not it is approved or not approved. And then we help the grantees determine where that funding can come from. We do have special funding from CIP funding, which is capital improvement project funding that we use for equipment. It's specifically earmarked for that. So we use that to purchase four-wheelers, ATVs, patrol vehicles if needed. In the last few years, or the last 4 years, all of our grantees have experienced lapse funding generally, and so we encourage them to use that lapse funding for those special projects or the large equipment purchases as we move throughout the year. So hopefully that answers the question.
It does. Thank you. I'd like to recognize that Representative Hannon and Representative Fields have joined us. Commissioner, and maybe Captain Merrill, this is a question for you. Looking back at the prior fiscal year denials that had been rejected by the department, there were funds that had been requested to support field training, sexual assault response training, pre-academy training, DARE officer training opportunities for our VPSOs. This morning we heard from Vivian Corthius about the challenge in terms of the department supporting the program overall. Can you speak to why those trainings were denied?
Captain Merrill, please.
Yes, Commissioner. Captain Merrill, for the record. Chair. So to answer that question, I would actually need to see the document of those requests that were actually denied because I don't have that information in front of me to compare with what the requests were. So I don't know that I have that information. There are some examples of training that could be denied would be like sexual assault investigation because VPSOs are not charged to conduct felony investigations. Typically, they will respond and assist with those depending on the complexity and the timeline that those cases are going to take. So there is some training that isn't appropriate for a VPSO to attend because it's not within their scope of work or what they are expected to do. We have provided specific training, for example, in the past year with CDVSA, which was first responder, health aid, VPSO-specific sexual assault training, which is how they, as the first responder, so health aides also aren't allowed to do certain types of examinations on victims of sexual crimes. They have to be done by a SANE nurse who is certified to do those examinations. The same with VPSOs. Our VPSOs aren't conducting the full-on interrogation of suspects or the interviews of victims because those are done in what we call the SART team model. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense to train a VPSO on a full SART exam process when they aren't going to participate in that. So we did develop that training that was provided. One of those trainings was actually held in Bethel at ABCP at the Tundra Women's Center shelter. So those kind of trainings we can do. So without seeing the form, I can't tell you exactly why those denials were made, but if that was provided, I'd be happy to respond.
That would be great. What we understand is that the justification that was given by the department was that there were budget cuts or no funds were available, and so we would appreciate a reconciliation done by the department and provided to my office to share with committee members. Representative Kopp, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Captain Merrill, for being with us today. A couple things. Your earlier statement about a regional village public safety officer support facility and that particular facility being denied because it wasn't located in a specific community. Aren't there a number of villages in close proximity along the river systems where a regional office would make more sense, you know, as a VPSO moves through several different villages in a day? I'm just trying to further understand what your thought was on why a regional one would be less ideal than one in a particular village. Thank you.
Captain Merrill, please.
Representative Kopp, through the chair. So one of the challenges that we've identified is the VPSO program at its root was developed to have a VPSO from the community, living in the community, working in the community. The troopers work on a regional hub and spoke model, if you will. So we have troopers that live in Bethel. We have troopers that live in Nome and Kotzebue and Fairbanks who respond to villages who don't have a public safety officer or police officer, TPO, VPO, that live and reside in the community. The challenge is when we added 15 VPSOs a year under a prior administration, we saw an increase in hiring the number of VPSOs to try to meet the request from the legislature and the villages to hire VPSOs. We saw a decrease in adherence to the standards that are established in regulation and statute, and we hired a lot of VPSOs. And then we saw that number, when budget cuts happened, significantly decline, as well as we saw the arming of the VPSOs create some additional barriers because we changed the structure and the functionality of the VPSO program, which was supposed to be a community service officer type officer in the community. And so we, with that increase in adherence to the standards and the regulations for qualifications of VPSOs, along with other challenges, we saw the numbers of our VPSOs decline. And so to try to meet some of that need to provide VPSOs, we strayed from the actual statutory intent of the program, which was to have that VPSO living in a community, working in the community. And so we created what were called rovers. The struggle with the rover program is we increased the cost of the program because now we're paying for per diem and flights and travel for a VPSO who should technically be based in a community. And so when we talk about a regional, we already have the regional sub-hub model with the troopers who respond to those villages. If we have a community, if we build that community center, let's say in Bethel, and we put two VPSOs or three VPSOs there, there is very little difference between that and what the troopers do with the trooper post. And so building that regional center diffuses even further the ability to have VPSOs that live in the community. It doesn't, if we have a VPSO in Bethel and a trooper in Bethel and the weather's bad and we can't get to a community, we can't respond and provide the service. So ultimately, that was part of the decision that went into that, was trying to adhere to the intent of what the VPSO program was, to have and hire VPSOs that live and work in the communities to provide that service on a regular basis.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just an observation. Thank you, Captain Merrill. So, you know, it's apparent that there's a struggle over what the intent of the program is. It's very clear from the Alaska Village Council that their VPSO vision is regional and community. It's not specific to one community. And it's very clear that the training function is law enforcement, search and rescue, EMS, fire suppression, life safety things. And because in rural Alaska there are weather delays to major crime scene responses, VPSOs do have to stabilize scenes, whether they be sexual assault or homicide or any other major crime, and sometimes it can be a day, 2 days before a trooper can get there, to no fault of the troopers. Just so I can see where there would be a challenge of saying, you know, how much training do we authorize if your vision is that they are not law enforcement and that that's a trooper responsibility, or if your vision is that they basically are the hands and the feet of the DPS in that community and that the DPS comes alongside them to support them in that role. So I think we have some role conflict. That's what we're hearing being played out, and we just have to figure it out. What's the best path forward? But I appreciate Captain Merrill your answers and Commissioner Designee Price, and I think we're highlighted for us why there's a little bit of a struggle.
Representative Lincoln,
I've got another question. So first of all, I just want to thank the commissioner and everybody on the line that. Any help we can get for public safety in the state is much appreciated. And I know even in the Northwest Arctic, there's a major difference when there's a trooper presence in a village and when there isn't. You could just the VHF traffic alone indicate that. One thing that I've been confused about is that, you know, we've had an issue recruiting and retraining VPSOs for a while, but we've also had an issue recruiting and retaining troopers. I think Representative Kopp has a bill for retirement benefits that I'm really interested in to try to help with that. And it seems like there's a difference in approach. So with the troopers and other law enforcement personnel, we have an issue recruiting, retaining people. We want to invest more. We want to find ways to make put more resources into it. But when we have an issue with recruiting and retaining VPSOs, the plan is to cut the program. And I don't understand that disconnect. Like, why are we putting more resources into one group that's providing this function and pulling resources from another? Like, what's the difference there?
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, thank you for your question. And I think Representative Kopp made a very astute observation that there is crossover that's taking place in the definitions of the positions of village public safety officer and Alaska State Trooper. They are statutorily different. They do receive dramatically different levels of training. And we, the department, has over the last several years tried to support recruitment efforts and retention efforts to include a host of activities, including higher bonuses, recruitment bonuses after serving a period of time as a village public safety officer, specific training to the coordinators. That is something that Captain Merrill and his team in the Village Public Safety Officer Program work really closely with the grantees on, is this question of how can the state help with recruitment. The challenge, multiple challenges, as we all know, but one of the challenges with regards to recruitment is the state is not recruiting those positions, nor are we hiring those positions. We are allocating the funding we receive from the appropriation to the nonprofits to do those activities. So I think we have a healthy relationship with the grantees on the topic of recruitment, and I think we've tried over the years different things. I have, you know, a binder of information that dates back decades, and of note is none of these topics are new. This is not the result of one administration or one decision or one policy challenge. Rural justice and rural public safety has been a challenge in this state since statehood. None of the ideas that we are discussing with regards to the Village Public Safety Officer Program are new. So recruitment and retention have been a challenge. I would just also like to put forward that the VPSO and Alaska State Troopers are two different job classes, just like a fire marshal and an Alaska State Trooper are two different job classes. Fire marshal is critically important to public safety. VPSO serves a critical function in public safety. They are different classifications, and we have different authority and opportunity to support them and hire them and recruit them. I would say, sir, that the negative supplemental that the governor introduced for FY19 still allows for every nonprofit to recruit and hire VPSOs. In fact, we have $250,000 that we have right now that we could give to nonprofits to hire. So the impetus for that negative supplemental was not to hurt the program, but as Ms. Corthius indicated, we have a hard time filling the positions, and the money wasn't going to be used. So that's why the governor introduced that negative supplemental. But the grantees still have full opportunity to hire. And some of the things that this department has done, for example, is authorize $40,000 to a grantee who indicated they would like to use that $40,000 to develop materials and in a recruitment effort. The department happily afforded and awarded that $40,000 for recruitment. So I think it's not a fair observation to suggest that recruitment is stronger in one over the other. I think we just have different scopes of authorities and different opportunities to influence their recruitment, and I would look forward to grantees bringing forward ideas on how the department could support recruitment efforts moving forward.
Just as an observation, in response to your comments, Commissioner Price, is that the governor's negative supplemental were funds that were going to be they were going to be unspent funds. But from what I understand, just through the course of this conversation this morning, is that those special projects and unexpended funds requests come at the end of the fiscal year, and that negative supplemental was introduced well before the end of the fiscal year, and so there's not been adequate time for the grantees to be able to submit funding that could be spent, rather than the department sweeping those dollars back in to reappropriate in other ways. To Representative Kopp's point, and along the same lines, I've heard you say several times in this committee and in other committees that the department doesn't oversee the management and delivery of the VPSO program, and in fact, you indicate that that relationship and that management rests with the grantees and the tribal nonprofits. However, it's very clear as we have these conversations that there are decisions that are being made that tie the hands of these grantees in order to be able to effectively deliver the program. And so, as an observation, moving forward, if the department is wanting to partner more holistically with tribes, I would be interested to hear your ideas on how we can pull back some of that bureaucratic red tape that seems to be hamstringing the program. Representative Ortiz has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before my question, Captain Merrill, if you're still there, I want to compliment you on your ability to answer questions with much more detail and much more explanation than you did when you were a high school student back in my classroom. So you made some great progress in that area. I'm going to compliment you on that. So my question is, you spoke earlier about, maybe not at this meeting, but evidently you've spoken previously about your view that the VPSO program has flaws, and we've talked about those. And you spoke about how the problem is not adequate resources, because you had resources in the past. And you show a slide here later on that talks of, you know, that shows the amount of resources that were available to the VPSO program. despite the numbers of VPSOs going down. So I'd like to hear, do you have a vision as to if you were had more authority or if you had more ability to, for lack of a better word, play God in this on this issue, do you have an idea how we could more effectively use those resources to fill those particular positions that are not filled and reverse that decline in VPSO availability? You see what I'm saying? If you have adequate resources and the problem's flawed, well then what's the solution?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, thank you for your question. And if I may just respond to the statement that the chair made, the funding that was pulled back in the negative supplemental is funding that has lapsed from the program in the last 2 years, which is why the governor thought that it was appropriate to use the funds, assuming that they were going to lapse again this year. And Sir Representative Ortiz, the department does have some ideas on ways that we can improve the program. And to the chair's point, some of those ideas include removing some of the regulatory controls that the department currently has in place. I'm sensitive to the fact that this department has not yet had the opportunity to engage in a comprehensive manner with the grantees, and we do have many recommendations that we are looking forward to providing to them on April 25th is the date of our meeting. I think and hope we've been working really hard that the grantees will be very grateful and relieved that some of the recommendations we have to put forward will improve the ability for them to recruit based on their own feedback, and that certainly includes what Representative the chair was referencing regarding challenges in the hiring program. So we do have some ideas. I don't have a comprehensive plan yet because we want the grantees to be part of building that plan. So the department has recommendations that we're looking forward to delivering to the grantees, but without question that multi-day meeting is solely focused on reviewing the recommendations the department has and hearing back from the grantees on how those recommendations would impact them. Are they positive? Are they negative? Is there unintended consequences? What are some of the grantees' recommendations so that we can walk out of that meeting with a collaborative grant agreement that's not one entity dictating to another entity what is going to work and what isn't. So those are all conversations that take place regularly. And in terms of approving special projects, I think sometimes it feels as if we can't see the forest for the trees. The intent of the program is to hire a member from the community to provide first response in the community. If the program were operating in that capacity, the topic of housing would not be one that would be so impactful because the individual would in fact already live in their community. How the program has grown is where some of the challenges come from. And I think as a body, as a state, the opportunity to evaluate the statutory obligation that governs the program is there to determine from the legislative body what the state views to be appropriate with regards to the Village Public Safety Officer program. The regulations that govern the program, which to be very frank with you, have not comprehensively been reviewed or updated since 1995, need to be evaluated and reviewed. But those regulations as they sit require that the village in partnership, again, this was a partnership with the state, provide office space, phone with long distance services and utilities. I think that there's great opportunity right now to evaluate the statute and also the regulations that haven't been looked at for a very long time and work to improve the program. But again, these challenges have been since the inception of the program, 40 years, all of these challenges, none of them are new. And I just don't have a solution for a decades-old challenge quite yet. I'm working on it. But I will look forward to providing everybody with what the result of our next grantee meeting is, which is going to be a grant agreement that looks a bit different than it's looked in the past and hopefully is encouraging to the grantees.
To your point, Commissioner Price, about housing, maybe this is an area where the department doesn't have great understanding about the challenges related to rural housing, but most of the communities throughout rural Alaska are overcrowded. There are a lot of multi-generational families that live in the same home. A lot of those homes are inadequate in terms of being able to provide efficient, affordable, quality housing throughout rural Alaska. And so, you know, as we are considering conversations about village public safety officers who are having to arrest potentially family members and friends, I take some issue with the department's perspective that paying for rural housing would indicate that we're veering from a model where local VPSOs are not being hired within their communities. Within my own district, 5 of the 6 VPSOs currently serving are from their home communities. And so as the department considers support for rural housing for VPSOs, that absolutely needs to be considered. We definitely welcome the department's presence in traveling with us to rural Alaska if a broader understanding of that is needed. I do want to highlight that you'd made a comment that the negative supplemental was lapse funding from the last 2 fiscal years. Previously, when we began having this conversation around special projects, I had highlighted that there were 2 previous fiscal years where there were unexpended dollars with the reason of the department that there were budget cuts or not enough resources. And so I would just encourage the department to be consistent in the manner in which it's communicating to people who are concerned about the VPSO program. And that may be contributing to some of the challenges in terms of us being able to move forward together productively for a stronger program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I might just comment, the department does have a deep knowledge of the challenges with regards to rural housing. We struggle with the rural housing component when we are placing Alaska State Troopers and all of the 800 employees that this department houses throughout the state to provide critical public safety services. I'm simply reflecting that the regulation that was drafted that governs and supports the program identifies that the villages to provide office space, phone, and utility with no reference of housing. I would put to the legislative body that if there is a desire to see something different, it's a great opportunity to include that in the statutory language.
Representative Edgman has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I appreciate your comment about the sort of the acknowledgement that the program has multiple flaws, and it's basically something that we need to address head on. And I think structural change is in order. And how we accomplish that, I think it's going to take some time. It's going to take some sort of forensic analysis and really delving into the program. But I was, having said that, I have to admit, I was struck when I watched some footage of you in previous committees. Basically, at least what I thought I heard you say is that the VPSO program, and just a moment ago you said the VPSO program and the state troopers are 2 different distinct job classes. And that seems very clear to me. But I think I've heard you before as well say that the VPSO, or at least the inference, or what I took away from it anyway, just watching from afar, was that a VPSO position is more expensive than a trooper position, something to that effect. And I think what you were doing is you were lumping in all the indirect costs, the actual costs of employing a VPSO, and then comparing that to a state trooper without adding the same cost to the trooper program. And I say that with a little bit of background because I chaired the Department of Public Safety budget for 4 years a couple years ago, dating back to a couple years ago. And to me, a state trooper position is way more expensive, as it should be when you compare those distinct job classes that you're talking about. So I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that because from what I took from that, and I'll be very direct here, almost seemed to be an indifference on your part to the VPSO program. And I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that and also maybe to clarify why myself and I think a bunch of others thought that you were basically implying that the VPSO program, per position is more costly than it is, vis-a-vis a state trooper position.
Representative Edgman, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. No, sir, I don't believe that I said that a VPSO is more expensive than an Alaska State Trooper. I believe that I said that they're a bit comparable in cost.
Well, madam, if I may just jump in, you also sort of insinuated that the indirect rate was as high as 48%. And when I watched that, that sort of caught my attention because there are some entities like Northwest Arctic Borough that has an indirect of 9% in the Bristol Bay Native Association, which has an indirect rate of 15%, and maybe one of the grantees that actually is at the 48% range. And it's my understanding that as well that, the department was working with that grantee to bring that indirect rate down to a more measurable rate and in alignment with the regulations, which to my surprise, and I think I'll maybe have this conversation with Captain Merrill, someone who I've worked with in years past and have a great amount of respect for, but regulations that haven't been updated since 1995 and a program that's clearly been structurally flawed and broken for some time now.
Representative Edgman, through the chairs, thank you so much. I would thank you for putting forward your frank statement. I find myself in an interesting position where providing data is often taken as insinuation, and just for this body and for the purpose of everybody in the room and listening, I am not a person who insinuates. I make statements, so never feel like you have to try to read between the lines. I'm trying to make data statements. The VPSO program is one of the arenas that I am responsible for. All of the prongs of public safety are of critical importance, every one of them. One cannot be successful without the other, including VPOs and TPOs, which are not on the, under the umbrella of the state's authority. So indifference, I think, certainly not. I think that trying to infer what my attitude or perception is based on data presented is just one of the many challenges of sitting at a microphone and trying to provide data.
If I could jump in, please. I would recommend that you choose your words a little bit more artfully, because that was the message that was directly left with me. And I'm somebody who's been around this building for quite a few years. I've seen a number of commissioners in your department come and go. I'm not questioning your dedication, your integrity, any of that, but I'm just saying that the message that was left with me and others was very different than what I'm hearing you're trying to portray.
Representative Edgman, the Village Public Safety Officer Program is, again, one prong. I am committed to rural public safety. I do not feel that this department nor this state should be limited in providing rural public safety to one program that is continually challenged. I believe that it's my obligation and responsibility to turn every stone over and try to find accurate, adequate, efficient solutions. It's uncomfortable to do so. I am committed to doing that, and I understand that it's a very problematic and challenging conversation to have. I believe that at the end of this, what we will walk away with is a more effective, faster, better rural public safety response. Maybe it looks like the VPSO program, maybe it doesn't. I don't know that, but I am committed to the conversation, and I'm passionate about the conversation. So I appreciate your...
If I could jump in, sure. To me, that's just all rhetoric. I've listened to you now for well over half an hour. I've yet to hear you say anything about any initiative that you might be spearheading to look at these structural flaws.
I mean, Representative Edgman,
I know you inherited this program. You've only been a commissioner for a couple of months, but you must have some idea about what you're going to do in the future, and I've yet to hear you talk about that.
Representative Edgman, did you not hear me make the statement earlier that on April 25th we are working with the grantees to deliver what our plan is for the Village Public Safety Officer Program and how to strengthen it?
I would ask the commissioner designee to manage tone in response to committee member. I would like to ask a follow-up question in the context of, is the department opposed to this particular committee has been established to identify opportunities to strengthen tribal partnerships where there's an area of shared interest. And the work that Representative Edgman has done, the work that Representative Kopp has done in trying to look at, and actually that our grantee spoke about on record this morning related to tribal compacting as a means to lift some of the bureaucratic burden that the department has. I would like to ask if the department is opposed to partnering with tribes in terms of recognizing tribal authority to support law enforcement efforts throughout rural Alaska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the interesting things that I've read as I've gone back through the paperwork associated with the Village Public Safety Officer Program is an opportunity that's been discussed. Commissioner Monaghan and Commissioner Folger both discussed it about, is there an opportunity to cross-deputize the VPSOs to enforce tribal law? And that conversation, I think, has been going on for quite some time. I don't have the department doesn't have a specific position on it right now. I think that it would be a really interesting conversation to have, and all of those conversations about how to strengthen the program are taking place, and I would just for the record apologize for the tone. Thank you, ma'am, and I apologize, Chair Edgman. I can't help but want to make sure that the committee is aware that the men and women who work on this program, including Captain Merrill and all of the VPSO office staff member and the grantees, work really hard on this program. And every day we're in these conversations, and we do have what I think is going to be a really well-received proposal. And I look forward, I actually very much look forward to that day. And I know that the committee and others in this building are interested in seeing that plan. we just made a decision as a department, and maybe it's not the right decision, and maybe we should reconsider it, that we wanted to deliver that plan to the grantees first so that they had the opportunity to make recommended changes before we put something out publicly.
Has there been any collaboration with grantees to this point that your office has reached out in order to meet with the grantees that are currently working, deploying VPSO programs?
Yes, Madam Chair. Captain Merrill, would you respond to the communication that takes place with grantees?
Yes, I'd be happy. This is Captain Merrill, Madam Chair. So we meet on a regular basis, at least quarterly the last few years. This year we actually increased the number of meetings with the VPSO grantee coordinators. I appreciate the commissioner's comments, because I've been in this position as the coordinator or the program commander for VPSO since 2014. And to Representative Ortiz's comment, yes, I had some great teachers who taught me well, so I do speak a little bit better than I used to. But I think, Madam Chair, it's important to understand that we have a great relationship with the coordinators. There are challenges structurally between what the department sees as the needs. We're a law enforcement focused organization. We have to kind of step out of that role and look at the other models of the fire safety. We have to work with the Fire and Life Safety Division to help understand that the VPSOs have that fire prevention nexus to their position. We have to look at the EMS side of it. We have to, we recently, in working with the grantee coordinators in our quarterly meetings, we identify challenges that face the program. We come up with potential solutions. We deploy solutions. We talk about the housing issue. I mean, I've lived in Bethel for 5 years and Nome for 5 years. I've worked in the Fairbanks region, rural villages. I've slept on gym floors because there's not a bed and breakfast or a hotel in communities as a trooper. I've slept on VPSO's couches. So having that experience and working with the coordinators who live in those regions, we regularly have conversations about how to solve problems. In the last year, we've identified the coordinators came. The way we held our meetings were very structured, and so we sat down and developed a new process in working with Tlingit Haida's coordinator, Jason Wilson. He said, it feels so formal that we can't really solve problems, and so this year we changed the way that we hold our meetings. We've become more open, collaborative, brainstorming-type sessions. We have coordinators who in the past would come to the meetings and not participate fully have now engaged, and they've brought wonderful ideas to the table. We have hard discussions in those meetings, and I truly appreciate the collaborative relationship that I have with all 10 coordinators. Now, we don't always see eye to eye, and so we have those meetings to discuss those challenges that we see, but we are working on solutions. And so sometimes it's presented that we have this bad relationship, but I think Jason Wilson presented at a meeting last week on Thursday, and one of the things he said is he has a good relationship with the department. We don't always see eye to eye, but we work through those challenges. And we all recognize that there are struggles with the structural development of this program. And so how do we work better to provide better public safety and better public services to our communities? And so we work on that. So hopefully that answers your question. Yes, we collaborate regularly. When we do quarterly reviews, we actually started last year. My staff goes out to each grantee, and they provide a site audit or a site visit, and we sit down and we review the things that we're required to review by statute, but we also look at ways that we can assist them in applying for federal grants. I think earlier one of the representatives asked a question about federal grants. Many of our grantees apply for federal CTAS, which is a combined solicitation for tribal funding from the federal government. And they receive those.
Captain Merrill, thank you for that. Captain Merrill, thank you for that response. I think what I'd like to drill down to, and the intention of my question, was to get a more specific response on who has the department been working with in the context of what grantees have been reached out to for this late April meeting.
Captain Merrill.
My staff worked with Jason Wilson, who is the coordinator point of contact for the coordinators, to develop the agenda for that meeting. That meeting actually happened last week. So the agenda for that meeting was built last Thursday. and so we're reviewing that with the coordinators, and the agenda will be provided to all the grantee coordinators, and then we'll prepare for the meetings that are coming up.
Representative Lincoln, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so as I understand it, AO 300 from last year requires each department to implement a consultation plan with tribes and via a tribal liaison. Does DPS have a tribal liaison?
Representative Lincoln, through the chair, I do not believe that we do, and I actually, sir, do not know if the department at the point that that was implemented identified one, but I could certainly look into that.
Okay. I did receive information that, in fact, Jason has not met with the department, and so I guess I would just ask for some clarity and follow up to make sure that those conversations are happening. I do want to step back just one moment to a moment ago when we were talking about indirect rates and a comment that Representative Edgman had made. I have also seen, Commissioner Price, those same comments on record about a wide variation of indirect rates. Last week we heard a presentation on how indirect rates are established at the federal level, and tribes and tribal nonprofits receive those indirect rates. We have heard you in committee discuss suggesting that there are indirect rates as high as 48%, but what we learned in committee last week is that there's a state cap of 30%. So how do you reconcile that?
Madam Chair, thank you. There is not a cap of 30%. There was legislative language that was put forward that the average indirect rate of the program should not exceed 30%. Each of the grantees are currently compensated for their full federally negotiated indirect rate, and that's a bit of a confusion, is that they do receive their full federal indirect rate. One of the challenges with the indirect rate, and actually an opportunity as I see it, is the staff has to make determinations on how they award funding to keep the average indirect rate of the program under 30%, as the legislative intent language indicated should happen. So as I'm having conversations, and perhaps Captain Merrill can speak to this as well, but one of my concerns was, when we started delving into that, is are we as a department not able to award funding to a grantee who perhaps has a higher federally negotiated rate because it might bump us up over that 30% average for the program? That was a question I had for my team, and I don't know the answer actually to that, but it does seem like an opportunity and a bit of a challenge. But yes, ma'am, that the indirect rate of 30% was legislative intent language. It is not a cap, and all of the grantees receive their full federal indirect.
We appreciate your understanding of that shared cap, but as it was presented to us, all of the contractors and all of the grantees that qualify for the VPSO program, it was indicated in that presentation last week, actually from a chief operating officer who had worked in tribal nonprofits for almost 20 years, that all of the contractors always remain under that indirect cap as a group. So although those indirect rates might be paid in full, typically the average is 30%.
Representative, Madam Chair, you're correct, and that's what I was reflecting as one of the challenges slash opportunities.
So maybe in future committee meetings, when this item is being discussed, not suggesting that 48% of an indirect rate is being paid out would be some, do you see where the confusion comes in, where people may take what you're saying as 48% is actually being paid, when in fact all of the indirect cap as a group is staying under 30%.
I do understand. Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the opportunity to speak to that. I'm actually going to ask Captain Merrill if you can address the way in which the indirect rates work and the allocation of fund to keep us under 30%. I think it's very challenging because we are not able to award money to a grantee if they have a much higher indirect rate, if it brings us up over that cap. So I can see the language is confusing, but we do, in fact, pay that full indirect rate to the grantees.
I appreciate the response, and in fact, we're coming to the end of our committee time. What I will end by saying is that it doesn't appear to me to be confusion. If we're talking about yourself as the commissioner suggesting in House Finance subcommittees that indirect rates are being paid out at 40%, when in fact in operation, most of the time as a collective, the tribal nonprofits are not paying more than 30% in their indirect rates, I think there's a bit of a discrepancy, and can understand Representative Edgman's concern that there might be insinuation that there's something wrong with the VPSO program or that it's too expensive.
So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, we appreciate your time today. We appreciate you taking some of these questions and understanding the difficulty around why we would be concerned about the solvency of the VPSO program. This is an imperative, as we heard this morning, to have six public safety officers for a region that has 48 communities within it is, I have no words to describe, incomprehensible that the department and the state, which is required to provide public safety throughout rural Alaska, is not meeting that standard. And so I appreciate that you have been responsive and poised in us asking the tough questions, but they have to be asked.
Thank you, ma'am.
So with that, I'm going to state that this Thursday, March 21st at 8 a.m., we will be hearing about the history and an update on the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact. The time is 9:58 a.m., and this hearing of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs is now adjourned.